General's Court is now in session. Please be seated and come to order.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready for argument now in the case of United States against Spears. Mr. Caramani.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ashwin Caramanchi, and I represent appellant Christopher Spears. This court asked whether the aggravated identity theft statute requires a theft or other misappropriation of identifying information when the prosecution relies on the knowing transfer part of the statute. Mr. Spears submits that the knowing transfer part of the statute does not require a theft, but does require a misappropriation of identifying information. In answering the question posed, Mr. Spears submits that the court should focus on the meaning of the word transfer. A transfer connotes more than what the government acknowledges. This court has recognized that the mere conveyance of information without more, or the mere conveyance of an object without more, is not a transfer. In order to constitute a transfer, there must be a conveyance not only of the information or object, but also of an interest or right associated with the information or object conveyed.
In this day and age of electronic files, hasn't the meaning of transfer been changed a bit? I mean, for example, if I email a document to my law clerk, I think of it as having been transferred to her, even if I still have a copy on my computer. Is that a transfer?
Your Honor, in that case, I would submit that that is not a transfer unless there has been some interest or right associated with that document that has also been conveyed. For example, if I have my wife's purse and I take her driver's license out of it and hand it to her, I have not transferred her name and date of birth, nor have I transferred her driver's license. On the other hand, if I have a younger brother who is under age 21, and I give him my license, and I tell him to take it, go to a bar down the street, and get himself a drink, I have transferred my license. I have conveyed an interest or right associated with that license to him.
But why isn't the critical thing there that this is a different person? I mean, if you look at the language of 1028, capital A, little a, 1, there are several things that it covers: transfer, possession, use. But then it has two other critical aspects: without lawful authority and a means of identification of another person. So the thing that interests me about this statute is whether, when we say another person, we think that the defendant has to transfer to a third party, someone who's not the person with this identity. Whether it was stolen, I mean, we can get to theft later, but whether it was stolen, whether it was just given, what have you. Because if there is a third-party requirement, one would come out one way in this statute. If there's not, if you can just, as the government seems to be saying, just keep handing it back and forth to one another and you're transferring each time, then there is no offense. So it's the other person, I think, in your second example, when you give it to your brother, that may be crucial.
Correct, Your Honor. I think the of another person language simply indicates that the means of identification has to be someone other than the defendant. The statute's purpose is to combat misbehavior with other people's identification.
But just other than the defendant? Because we have two possibilities. Maybe this is an ambiguous term. One possibility is illustrated by this case, where we have Ms. Payne giving her identifying information to Mr. Spears. He manufactures the phony gun permit. He gives it back to her. It's an entirely internal transaction that they're all happy with. There's no misappropriation. There's no theft. There's nothing. If she had given him her identity and he had manufactured a phony gun permit that had been sold in the streets of Gary to a third person, you know, Jones, then surely you would agree that the statute's been violated.
Correct, Your Honor. I'm not sure that a
you
third...
You have to get outside that group of people who are engaged in the transaction.
That's one way that the statute can be violated, Your Honor. I would also submit that had Mr. Spears transferred Ms. Payne's identifying information to himself, that also would have been a violation of the statute. He would have transferred the means of identification of another person to himself. So there's not a third party in that situation, but there still is a transfer of a means of identification.
What about the transfer to Tony? That sort of a, you know, plain old-fashioned transfer to another person.
You know, the government submits that when Mr. Spears handed the document to Tony, that was, in fact, a transfer. My argument is that, in the first instance, the handgun carry permit itself was not a means of identification. The means of identification at issue are Ms. Payne's name and date of birth. The government cites to Section 1028I to claim that the means of identification could include the handgun carry permit itself. But as I note in my reply brief, that particular statute does not apply to Section 1028A1.
Would you think that a passport is a means of identification?
No, Your Honor. It's not a means of identification.
Isn't in ordinary usage a passport a means of identification or a driver's license a means of identification? If you want to get past the TSA stations at the airport, you show your means of identification. That's a driver's license, passport. Your argument sounds like it depends on the proposition that passports and driver's licenses are not means of identification.
Your Honor, the statute specifically defines means of identification in 1028D7. And in that particular provision, means of identification is defined as any name or number with which someone can identify a specific individual. Huh? That definition does not include identification document.
What? So a name or number becomes not a means of identification if it's incorporated into a document, even though the whole point of the document is to convey some of these bits of information?
According to the definition in the statute, yes, Your Honor, I would submit that the document itself is not a means of identification, only the information, the identifying information within that document. The statute is directed toward combating the transfer.
But if you're transferring the document, you're transferring the information.
That could be so, Your Honor, but I would say that, for example, when I hand a driver's license back to my wife, that is hers, I'm not transferring her name and date of birth. I'm simply giving her a document that contains her name and date of birth. There's no conveyance of a right.
Transferring in the sense of turning her into another person. Let me ask you, I'm puzzled by the relation between 1028 and 1028A. And in particular, if you look at subsection A7 of 1028, it's essentially identical to 1028A1. What's that about?
Your Honor,
I'm also puzzled by the fact that the effective date of 1028 is actually after the effective date of 1028A. And I'm curious whether this subsection 7, however, preceded the first subsection of 1028A. Because if it did, then one interpretation of 1028A is that it took subsection 7 from 1028 and promoted it to a more serious crime because it provides for the 2 years. Is that what happened?
I believe that is what happened, Your Honor. I cannot say for sure, but I do believe that in 2004 the aggravated identity theft statute was enacted, and that statute prescribes the transfer, use, or possession of a means of identification in relation to specific.
So I also notice, I think I'm correct, that in 1028, the term another person appears only in 7. And it makes me wonder whether 7 is about what we think of as identity theft, and that Congress at some point noticed that in this long list of identification theft prohibitions, they had buried identity theft, the most serious, and so then they decide to promote it by enacting 1028A, and now they have an extra prison sentence. Is there any evidence for that conjecture as to what's going on here?
Your Honor, I think the evidence is that there were specific enumerated felonies in the aggravated identity theft statute that Congress wanted to combat in relation to the transfer, use, or possession of means of identification. 1028A7 combats any transfer, use, or possession of a means of identification in relation to any federal felony. The aggravated identity theft statute is more limited in the felonies during relation to which a defendant has to commit that felony in which to be guilty of the offense.
So I'm interested. I mean, you've called this the aggravated identity theft statute a couple of times, and that's what Congress decided to call it. But you said, if I was understanding you correctly a few minutes ago, that you didn't think theft was part of the statute, that the transfer part of the statute that we're focusing on didn't require the theft of identity of another person.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Despite the fact that the statute is called identity theft.
Correct, Your Honor. There's nothing that I can find within the text of the statute that requires the theft. And I would note that...
Well, the Supreme Court in the Flores-Figueroa case actually looked at the title of the statute. We don't always look at titles, but the court itself did pay attention to the title of this statute. Doesn't that give us some sense of the scope if you're a textualist?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Flores-Figueroa was looking at an entirely different question.
I realize that they were talking about the knowing requirement, but it is a fact that they were construing this statute, and they said things about this statute that seems to me we ought to be cognizant of.
That's true, Your Honor, and I would also note...
I thought your argument was that the relevant theft in 1028A is the theft of the identity, not the theft of a document.
Your Honor, my
I can steal someone's... I can steal someone's passport and use it to some purpose that doesn't affect the other, that it doesn't affect the victim at all. He's lost his passport, he gets it replaced, but that's all. I thought identity theft means by taking someone else's identity, you start taking things from him and screwing up his credit and all that stuff. I thought that was what the problem. So there's certainly, that's theft. It's just theft of something else.
Your Honor has described the classic case of identity theft. That's correct. But my argument is more focused on the meaning of the word transfer.
What's an unclassical form of identity theft?
Well,
identity theft is taking someone's identity for your purposes, and as a result of the other person having his identity stolen, you know, his financial affairs get screwed up. That's why people are so angry about identity theft. It's not that they lost a document. It's that now someone is, you know, they're getting billed for stuff that other people are buying by using their identity. Isn't that what the concern is?
That is a concern, Your Honor. You're correct.
But here isn't the big issue this another person situation, because it doesn't make sense for Congress to punish someone for transferring sensitive information to someone who already had it, right? The most common sense reading of the statute is that it punishes the transfer of identifying information to someone who didn't already have it, to a third party, because that's what leads to the harms that Judge Posner is making reference to that society is concerned about. So when you read this another person, doesn't it make more sense to describe someone who was not involved in the transfer? It's a third person.
That is one way in which the statute can be violated, Your Honor. But I would also...
It's the way. It's transfers without lawful authority, a means of identification of another person.
You know, people are throwing you lifelines here. The puzzle is that you don't seem to be seizing them.
No, Your Honor, I understand that, but my argument is also focused on the meaning of the word transfer and the fact that it simply requires...
Like, why?
Yeah, it seems like you're hung up on it, because if you say, I'm transferring this document which belongs to another person, most people wouldn't think that the person to whom the document is being transferred is another person, especially if it's that person's information.
Yes,
well,
Your
don't
Honor.
You win under that theory?
I do win under
okay.
that theory, absolutely.
But
I would
just a moment here.
Now
though,
you should sit down.
I think that forgets about Tony, though. Tony is in the middle on both sides of this. Tony gets the money from Ms. Payne, transfers it to the defendant, gets the document back, and takes it back to Payne.
Right. But I would, Your Honor, the handgun carry permit itself is not a means of identification. And under that argument, then, Tony simply was not a part of the transfer because...
It contains a means of identification.
It does.
It does contain
a means of identification.
You can't metaphysically parse it out that way. That's just not going to work. And the emphasis on the word transfer doesn't work very well either, because transfer, in its ordinary meaning, has a much broader connotation than the one that you're suggesting. It does not apply a transfer of ownership. It can. That's a subset of the possibilities of transfer in this context, but that's not the of transfers that are captured by this statute, which casts a very broad net. So you're going to have to tie it to the rest of the language in the statute, and I think that's where the questions from the bench are trying to direct you. So maybe you want to...
Correct, Your Honor. I understand.
Let
me try throwing a different lifeline with the phrase without lawful authority. Because I'm assuming that means something different from the underlying predicate crime in the aggravated identity theft statute.
Correct, Your Honor. In my brief, I argue that without lawful authority simply means in a manner contrary to law. There have been five other circuits that have addressed the issue squarely, and all have concluded that that's what the without lawful authority language means. It simply means in a manner not contrary to law.
Well, that really doesn't mean anything. All right. Well, go ahead.
So when Ms. Payne first gives her name and date of birth to Mr. Spears, does that qualify as without lawful authority in your view? I'm just trying to break down the transaction now.
No, Your Honor.
So she does have lawful authority to give her name and date of birth to Mr. Spears?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
For
even
his
though
use?
She
Not for his use, but...
Well, that's where I wanted to go, too. I want to, does her motive make any difference? So, you know, I might give my passport to my next-door neighbor when I go out of town to visit family for safekeeping. So I've given my passport, which you're going to have to indulge me, is a means of identification, to my neighbor. But nobody is going to say that I did that for any terrible reason. I just did it for safekeeping. If I gave my passport to my neighbor because I was trying to go into the phony passport business and he was going to use it as a template to make fraudulent U.S. passports, that might be a different matter. So does motive make any difference in that initial transfer? You've agreed Payne could give her identification to Spears.
I don't think motive makes a difference, Your Honor. I think it's simply whether or not it is violative of the law.
Okay, so does Spears actually transfer in the sense that this statute is talking about when he uses Tony as an intermediary, or is that the same as if he personally found Payne again and gave these documents back to her?
No, Your Honor, he did not transfer because there was no conveyance of a right associated with that information to a third party, to another
party. Mr. Kanaji, isn't your argument that Spears committed identity fraud, not identity theft?
He did. That's part of the argument, yes, Your Honor. He did not.
Well, isn't that the core of it?
Yes, that is the core of the argument. He did not commit a theft of another person's identity. He did not.
He was about identity fraud.
Correct. Correct. He did not misappropriate another person's identity. There was no theft. There was no...
So he's a criminal because he takes this stuff and makes a phony gun permit with it, but he hasn't stolen anyone's identity because there's no third party involved. There's no another person.
Correct, Your Honor. There's not anyone, and there's no victim.
But it has nothing to do with how many transfers happened.
Correct, Your Honor. That is one way of looking at that statute. There is no victim. There is no theft. There is no third party that's taken that information and appropriated it for his or her own use. So there is no crime under the language of the statute.
Well, there's always a public victim when these sorts of offenses are committed, is there not?
Correct, Your Honor. But I think, again, the court looks at the of another person language, and in that sense, there is no victim. If I may reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Holler.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. To prove a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1028A, the government need not establish the theft or misappropriation. Spears has conceded here that theft of information is not required.
What's your notion of the relation between 1028A7 and 1028A1?
Your Honor, 1028A7 was enacted in 1998, and it was enacted, the original statute was enacted in 1982 to combat fraud with documents. As the Internet grew and as the spread of information grew, fraud that used to be based on essentially stealing blank driver's licenses or blank Social Security cards and typing your information in began to focus instead on the theft of the driver's license number or the Social Security number itself. And so in 1998, Congress updated the statute to cover not just the theft or not just the misuse of identification documents or false identification documents, but the misuse of the means of identification itself. Then in 2004, there was a, I believe 2004, is as my colleague pointed out, there was an attempt again to essentially update and increase the penalties for these behaviors in specific instances. So 1028AA1 is a narrower version of 1028A7. That's exactly what it is. And at 1028A7, as you can see from the second part of the statute, essentially the fourth element, the element that's kind of dropped out of this case completely, the fourth element of 1028A7 is that it has to be in connection with any unlawful activity that constitutes a violation of federal law or any state or local felony. Then the comparable provision in 1028A1 is that it has to be in during and in relation to a specific defined felony that's listed in 1028AC. So it only covers
that's
specific...
That's a huge list, right? It's yeah. Not only 11 items, but most of them have all sorts of subdivisions.
I don't dispute that, Your Honor, but it's still a much narrower list than every state or local felony. It's a much narrower list than that. And the point, even if it is a broad list, I think that the point of the statute, if one looks at the, for those who care about the legislative history of the statutes, I think that the point of the statute was that Congress thought that they were going to enact 1028A7 and suddenly these were going to be penalized very heavily,
there's
and they weren't.
There's nothing in 1 to 6 in 1028 that limits it to the creation of a identification document which doesn't have anybody's name.
Well, I think that these terms are overlapping, Your Honor. It's not, I mean, a means of identification.
Yes, certainly overlapping, and one interpretation is that 7 is for identity theft.
Well, I think that the answer to that, though, I think is twofold. First of all, the legislative history suggests it's about both identity theft and identity fraud, as Judge Flom pointed out. There are discussions in the statute about identity fraud as well, and it is designed to cover both.
1 to 6 covers identity fraud.
Well, it doesn't necessarily cover identity fraud.
No, it covers identity fraud plus what you started with, which is just, you know, writing down Mickey Mouse's name on it.
Again, Your Honor, the statute provides in, for example, 1028A2, if an identification document is stolen. In 1028A6, it talks about if identification documents used to defraud the United States have been stolen or produced without lawful authority. So it would have been incredibly easy if Congress had wanted to limit this to theft for it, instead of having pulled the term without lawful authority, which really refers to identity fraud, to have pulled the term stolen. That's what one would expect.
Yeah, I'd like to bring us back to 1028A.
Okay.
Whether 1028A covers identity fraud probably depends on the meaning of the word another. We asked the parties to brief that question, and neither side took us up on it. But this is your opportunity. It seems to me there are at least three possible meanings of the word another. It may mean the person other than the transferor. It may mean the person other than the defendant. Or it may mean the person other than the one to which the identification, the information, pertains. Now, which one of these is the right meaning of the word another, and why?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the term another person should be, I believe, what the defendant himself stated, which is that it should be anyone other than the defendant.
That's an assertion, but why? There are three possible readings, and I ask you why you would choose one rather than, I dare say it, another. Suppose this were a prosecution not for the transfer of information, but for, say, the possession of information. And it's the same structure, because it says possession, transfer, use. So suppose somebody is prosecuted for possessing information of another. Who's the another in that construction? You'd think it would mean the person whose identity was being misappropriated. And then my question is, if that's the meaning in the when we deal with a possession prosecution, why don't we use the same meaning when we deal with a transfer prosecution?
I guess I have a two-part answer to that, which is I believe first, Your Honor, that the definition of another person is a person other than the person on trial, a person other than the defendant. That is the most natural reading.
Possible reading. But you haven't yet given an argument for why it is the right reading, given the three possible meanings of the word another.
I confess I don't completely understand the question. I think the question is, what is the most natural reading, and is there some reason not to read it in that particular fashion? But typically in the guidelines.
If you think about the idea of identity theft, right, which is I assume the core of this statute, it may reach identity fraud as well as identity theft, but the core of identity theft is Jones is pretending to be Smith. That is, he's using information pertaining to another, Smith's Social Security number. And the normal understanding of another in that construction is the person whose information has been misappropriated. The question I'm asking is, why wouldn't it have the same meaning when we deal with the transfer possibility as well as when we deal with the use or possession possibilities?
Well, I guess I think that the term should be construed similarly in all three. I do agree with
that. It's the same word.
Right.
Because the statute says transfer, possess, use information of another, et cetera.
Well, correct, Your Honor. And so that's why, for certain, one cannot locate this solely in the word transfer, because if that were the case, then the government in the next case, when this occurred, would simply charge Mr. Spears with possessing the means of identification another person, not with transferring.
To follow up on what Judge Easterbrook is saying, in between that trio of verbs, transfers, possesses, or uses, and the words another person, is the without lawful authority. And so I have two points about that. One is whether, if in Judge Easterbrook's example, Smith gives his identification means to Jones, whether you think that's without lawful authority. And the second thing I just wanted to point out is that when the government argued Flores-Figueroa, it said in the brief for the United States that the unmistakable purpose of Section 1028, capital A1, is to provide enhanced protection for victims. The statutory text makes it clear that the sine qua non of the offense is the presence of a real victim, et cetera, et cetera. So why doesn't that help us choose among the meanings of another person that Judge Easterbrook has said? Or has the government now disavowed the idea that this is a victim-focused statute?
The government does not disavow that the central objective is victim-focused, is on identity theft. But it also does not disavow...
Where's the victim here? It's not Spears and it's not Payne.
Well, for Your Honor, the victim is the public. There are other instances where the only victim is going to be the public, including, for example, in the Lefebvre case, where the victim had been, you know, dead for years, her estate had been closed. The only real victim was the public and the public's interest in preserving the correct use of identities. So it does extend beyond the court.
That's what the government said in Flores-Figueroa brief. The sine qua non is the presence of a real victim. Now, they wouldn't have, I don't think they would have worded it that way if they just wanted to say it's a public offense. And it's not as though there aren't other tools in the arsenal for the government for identity fraud, other kinds of offenses that you like to sweep into this statute.
To get back to your question about the term without lawful authority, Your Honor, just to make clear to the court, our position is that a transfer, whether it is a transfer without lawful authority, a possession without lawful authority, or a use without lawful authority, one looks to underlying state or local law violations. So here our position is that the violation of Indiana code that was stated in our brief that prohibits the distribution of counterfeit documents, that is what it means to be without lawful authority. And
but
multiple
it wasn't a counterfeit document. At what point of the transaction does that happen? Not when Payne first gives her information to Spears. There's nothing that's been created. He might have gone out of business and moved to Montana at that point. You know, so when does the violation happen?
The violation happens when he transfers the counterfeit document, which is a violation to distribute a counterfeit document. When he distributes that means of identification to Tony is when it occurs, and he's doing that so that Tony will then in turn transfer it to Payne.
So do you think there would have been no violation if he had just given it to Payne directly?
I don't, Your Honor, but if the court takes a narrower view of another person, then that would be a distinction that one would make. If the court agreed with that, I think there would still be a violation because the transfer to Tony is to another person, a third party.
But we
believe it is broader than that. I'm sorry.
I understand you'd be saying another person could be a court.
Well, yes, Your Honor. In the Lefebvre case, the court, in fact, said that. In the Lefebvre case, a woman stole the
innovative
deceased person.
Why did Congress entitle this aggravated identity theft if it's identity theft plus fraud?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I don't think, though. I think it is clear from the references.
Are these just arbitrary labels? They just have a few labels, so they stick with
I think it would be very strange to construe 1028A7 and 1028A1 to include only identity theft and not identity fraud.
What's strange, but we know identity theft is a crime that really disturbs people because, you know, they're financial affairs get all screwed up and they spend all sorts of... I mean, it's a horror for people. So you could understand why there'd be a little statute that's just about identity theft. Why would... If Congress wanted to duplicate the rest of 1028, why wouldn't it give it a different title?
I think, though, that 1028A7 does not state anything... 1028 itself does not state anything related to theft. And no one has ever construed, in 15 years, 1028A7 to include only theft. It is replete with cases involving fraud.
No,
and in fact,
the whole point. 1028A7 is identity theft.
Again, Your Honor, in the legislative history, as we pointed out as well, recites...
Because 1028.1 through 6 certainly embraces fraud. It's about fraud.
Again, I think that I disagree with that, Your Honor, because
What do you think the crimes are in 1 through 6?
I think the crimes in 1 through 6 could involve, for example, in the Shee case, taking a blank identification document and distributing it out so other people could use them. It could involve...
But you're creating fraudulent documents? That isn't fraud?
There's no doubt, Your Honor, that the court is concerned when individual means of identification are involved.
You can't argue that 1028 is necessary because fraud isn't covered. 1028 is necessary because 1028 doesn't cover fraud.
I'm not.
1028 covers.
1028 covers all aspects. The idea was
all aspects, precisely, including fraud and including identity theft. Then they single out identity theft for a higher, heavier punishment.
Again, Your Honor, I do not understand why the court would
why
have not
you
said
think they passed 1028A1 when they already 1028AA1 when they already had 1028A7.
To impose a mandatory minimum penalty for violations of specific statutes.
For
that's the reason.
Aggravated identity theft statutes. That's what Congress has told us it is. They're narrowing it. If you wanted to look through all the legislative history, there's quite a bit that focuses on victims of identity theft. And when somebody steals somebody else's identity, another person, a term which I think, contrary to what the government says in its brief, is an ambiguous term that requires some interpretation, that's what you have. That's what warrants the greater punishment under capital A1.
Again, Your Honor, and as all of the courts that we pointed out on page 16 of our brief, I believe six other courts of appeals have all considered this question, and all of them have indicated that the statute is not limited to theft.
Many of those courts were not talking about transfer.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor, that they were not talking about transfer, but I don't...
And the idea of another person is a little different, because a transfer is a bilateral transaction. That's why we have to disambiguate it. If you're just talking about use, then anybody on the outside is another person. If you're just talking about possession, then anybody on the outside is another person. If you're talking about bilateral transaction, transfer, you have a new layer of interpretation you need to deal with.
Well, and if the court feels that the focus is on the word transfer, then the court can certainly make that interpretation.
Well,
but in future cases...
That Spears has taken a completely textualist approach to this matter. What's the meaning of transfer? And I don't understand from your argument how you've met that point, which seems to me to be quite powerful.
Well, a transfer, Judge Cudahy, is simply a conveyance. It's simply a transfer. If I were to hand you my driver's license right now, I have transferred it to you. I haven't done so without lawful authority, and I haven't transferred, in that instance, a means of identification of another person because it's my own and I would be the defendant. But I have assuredly transferred it to you. One has to look at all of the terms. One can't just focus on one specific term. And if one were to focus narrowly on the word transfer, then the next time the government is going to be back here, the next time, you know, Mr. Spears Jr. does this, and we're going to be charging possession. We're going to charge that he possessed this or that
he
used it to create... I'm sorry.
Well, that's another problem. I don't see that. Well, that's our problem.
Well, let's talk about possession for a moment. Let's suppose we've got a number of predicate crimes here that can be... that can support a charge under 1028A, right? Suppose it's mail or wire fraud, and in the course of that, one of two co-conspirators asks the other to hold her purse or to hold his wallet. The other person is then in possession of means of identification in the course of the predicate crime. Is that a violation of 1028A?
I think that the court could look to the Kasenga case or the Abdul Shafi case, which talk about it has to have somehow...
I've looked at Abdul Shafi, and I'm troubled by it, I should tell you. But we'll go there in a moment if you'd like.
Well, I understand that then, Judge Hamilton. But I do think that if it's simply an incidental use, if it doesn't in any way, if it isn't somehow in furtherance of the felony...
Where do you see that in a capital A1?
Well, I guess I would probably Judge Hamilton's hypothetical located in the without lawful authority point. I'm not sure how giving one's purse to another person. Huh?
I agree. So would I.
So that's why I would say it's not in that instance. But if one co-conspirator gave one's identification, you know, if I give my social security number to you or my passport to you so you can commit a federal felony that's listed in the offense, then you have now used it, and if somebody else transfers you my identification to do that, then they have transferred it.
What work in your analysis does the term of another person do? What does that add to the statute?
Well, I think it eliminates the possibility, Your Honor. I think it's more focused on the use example, but it eliminates the possibility of every fraud becoming identity fraud. If I use my own identification to commit fraud, I haven't violated this particular statute.
I understand you. You think this statute criminalizes fraudulent use of identity documents. What difference does it make whether it's another person's identification document or simply a made-up identification document, a Social Security number that doesn't exist for anybody?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that when one uses real identifiers, the identifiers of real people, those are often included in databases. Real Social Security numbers are included in databases. One can often tell whether a number exists or doesn't.
Is it easy to catch these people if they use a...
I think it's normally... I'm sorry.
Is it easier to catch a person if he's using identification of another person who's in a database?
I think it's harder to catch someone if they're using identifiers of other real people than if they're using completely made-up information, is at least what Congress believed and envisioned when they enacted the statute. I do believe that that is the theory, that identity fraud is harder to detect than ordinary fraud, just making up information. If I'm actually... posing as another person, whether that other person wants me to pose as that person or is horrified that I'm posing as that other person, it can be harder to detect the offense, and therefore that is part of that additional bond.
Well, isn't that identity theft, though?
If the other person consents to my use of their identity, no, it's identity fraud. If I give you my passport so that you can illegally remain in the country, that's identity fraud. But if I consent to your use of it, it is not identity theft. I know full well that you're posing as me and pretending to be me. It's not identity theft. It's
now,
identity fraud.
Is all that forbidden by 1 through 6?
Depending on...
28?
And Your Honor, these are overlapping statutes. There are many instances...
So the case you give, that's already forbidden.
I think, Your Honor, that that's absolutely true.
And yet they didn't pick up 1 through 6 and add it to 1028A. They just took 7.
They did, Your Honor.
But
that is true.
But you're saying 7 added nothing to 1 through 6.
Seven was added because people were taking free-form Social Security numbers or free-form...
7 is narrower than 1 through 6.
They're overlapping, Your Honor.
You just said it was narrower.
Because
it's limited to where you take actual identification information out and making it up from scratch.
The statute focuses essentially on three different things: identification documents, false identification documents, and means of identification. And there are a few other things as well. An identification document can be a means of identification, but it doesn't have to be. An identification document under 1028D3 is an item that, when completed with information concerning an individual, is accepted for identification. This doesn't happen that much anymore, but in 1982 when the statute was enacted, a blank Social Security card, a blank template, would have been an identification document, but not a means of identification. A false identification document is a phony made-up form. It's one that wasn't issued by the government but looks like it was. It could be, if it's completed with somebody else's information, a means of identification, but it might just be a false identification document. Congress believed that when means of identification, things that belonged to actual people, living or dead, were involved, it made it harder to detect the crime. It often, though not always, impacted individual victims, and that was higher and of more, you know, more problematic than just stealing blank documents or making up false information. Whether Congress was correct in that assessment, I don't know. But I do know that that is why Congress thought that this was a more important and more problematic thing.
Identity theft is not punished any more severely than a form of identity fraud that involves the same mechanism of using some real person's identification.
By statute, yes.
They're punished the same.
I think that there are provisions in the guidelines that tend to...
The guidelines. The statutory punishment is the same.
Yes, Your Honor.
But don't most people consider identity theft worse?
I'm sure that the individuals that it happens to.
The case from voluntary transfer of my passport for you to use, from your stealing my passport, representing yourself to be me, and causing enormous inconvenience. Your view, both are the forbidden by 1028A and punished identically from a statutory standpoint.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree that the without lawful authority has to mean something in addition to the underlying predicate?
I think that it does. I don't know that it has to in terms of the fact that there's overlap and Congress often lists 10 or 15 different examples. For example, in the statute itself, Your Honor, it seems very hard for me to think exactly what additional work, unless one were to interpret transfer the way the defendant wants to, the word possess really could ever do in the statute. In order to possess something in furtherance of a felony, I'm not really able to come up with a situation where one wouldn't either transfer or use it in some way. But that said, I do believe that without lawful authority does do the additional work of requiring that the transfer, the possession, or the use itself be essentially violative of the governing body that issued the document or the means of identification.
So you
let me try this is tax week. Okay, so let me just try a different hypothetical on you.
Okay.
Let's suppose an accountant and a taxpayer agree to commit tax fraud, which could also be prosecuted as one of these predicate felonies, wire or mail fraud, with some false deductions. The taxpayer provides identifying information to the accountant. The accountant puts it on the return, sends it back to the taxpayer, and it goes on to the United States government. Is that chargeable under your theory of 1028A? For a transfer of the taxpayer's identifying information during and in relation to the fraud?
The transfer, so the false information or the deductions that are included?
Those are false. But there's nothing false about the Social Security number, let's say. But it's the means of identification of another person being used and transferred during and in relation to the commission of the underlying fraud.
I think, Your Honor, that sounds somewhat similar to the Judge Howard's hypothetical in the Kasenga opinion, which suggests that in that case the filing of an immigration document where there are many falsehoods that are made and the person is doing a spousal permit, that would not be included. So my suspicion is that if there's nothing illegal about an accountant filing a tax return and the only falsehoods that are included are underlying related to the offense itself, then it's hard for me to see how that's particularly different than any other form where there's no – I mean, it doesn't seem like there's even any identity fraud of any kind that's occurring in that case.
No, there doesn't. But it does seem to fall within your theory.
Well, I'm not sure in what way there would have been a transfer that would have been in any way violative of the law. I mean,
so it's without lawful authority.
That's again where I would locate it, Your Honor, and that's what we have said. We think that is the addition where this comes in. And again, why, Your Honor, not any transfer counts, but in this case where the transfer is of a document that is a counterfeit document, where the distribution of that document is prohibited by Indiana law, we believe that is sufficient under the statute. And at a minimum, certainly the transfers or the uses of means of identification of other people, if I give my Social Security number to another person who then uses it, even though there's no identity theft that occurs, we do believe that still violates both 1028A7 and 1028A1.
But in that case, you at least have somebody pretending to be someone they're not, right? Hmm.
You have yes, but I mean, we would construe identity fraud broadly to include misuses of identifying information. So there was a misuse of identity.
That's so far afield from identity theft. I mean, certainly I can imagine a world in which we want to punish all misuses of personal identifying information, and we do under a number of statutes. I don't think anybody disagrees that that's punishable. But trying to make everything fit under this statute is what the problem is.
But I guess I again go back.
So far afield from the words of the statute.
I don't believe that it is, Your Honor, because I believe that that one could have easily said if one knowingly transfers, possesses, or uses a stolen means of identification or a misappropriated means of identification. But that's not commonly what the term without lawful authority means. That's appealing to the authority that issued the document. And that's what the term without lawful authority means in 1028A2. That's what it means in 1028A6.
Well,
and so
it certainly includes that. The concept of without lawful authority is not just contrary to state or federal law. It includes without permission of the owner.
Right, Your Honor. But it also means that even if it's done with permission of the owner but without the permission of the state or issuing authority.
And I have a separate question about the meaning of the phrase a means of identification of another person. Is it possible that that just means someone outside the transaction?
Well, I guess gets right back to Judge Easterbrook's question as well. And I confess I don't have a better answer other than the one I got. I'm sorry to say that. But I think it could, again, like you said, mean something outside the transaction. But I think that the pull against that essentially is what I've said before, which it just sort of seems to mean that in the future the government isn't going to charge transfer. It's going to charge possession or, in most cases, when it can, use. And I'm not sure why that. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That would affect who gets charged. I mean, I'm not very bothered about the government choosing which part of a statute to charge under.
I'm not either, but I do think it almost renders the transfer superfluous. Because
no, it would cover everybody outside the transaction, as Judge Sykes was just saying. So the two people in the transaction, Spears and Payne, don't get charged. But if Spears is involved with other people's identity, there are all sorts of transfer.
Certainly,
offenses.
Your Honor. But again, in this instance, Spears did transfer the document to Tony. So there is someone outside of the transaction. I mean, it would seem to me then that in this particular instance, the violation would still fall within the statute because of that. That's rather happenstance.
What happened to the rule of lenity? The way you're talking, you're actually acknowledging that this is ambiguous.
I don't believe that it is ambiguous,
clear.
Your Honor.
I mean, your answers seem rather tentative, actually. Isn't it ambiguous? Who knows what Congress is talking about? You have the title of the statute, you have the mystery of another person, you have the relation between this and 1028. Why is it all very foggy?
Whatever fogginess there is in the statute, Your Honor, it is clear that it is not limited to stolen. It is clear that it is not limited to theft. And on that, Your Honor,
text is at least ambiguous about whether another person is a victim or someone uninvolved in the transfer, we can certainly look at the caption of the statute, which seems fairly clear, or we can apply the rule of lenity, can't we?
I think, Your Honor, that the rule of lenity is only supposed to apply if there is ambiguity, and the text of a statute cannot override, or I'm sorry, the title of a statute cannot override the clear text.
Why can't it create an ambiguity?
Or disambiguate.
The title, but Your Honor, the text is abundantly clear that this is beyond stolen. It's beyond theft.
Do you think titles to statutes are entitled to no interpretive waive?
No. I think that they are entitled to interpretive weight. But when the word stolen, which I consider a synonym
but only
to theft,
when they favor our position.
No, Your Honor. I do think that the word that stolen and theft to me are the same word, and when the word stolen is used throughout the statute and not in this statute, it indicates to me that while the core of the statute is aggravated identity theft, it must extend to other instances of use, transfer, or possession without lawful authority, which is greater than theft.
Let me ask you one final question. At the end of the day, isn't this case really about making a false identification document, which Spears has already been punished for? And so what is really being added by this aggravated identity theft charge?
I think that in almost every instance, the 1028A offense is going to be adding something onto another felony. So that's what it's adding. What it is adding is that there was a misuse of identifications here, and I think that is what is being added and what is being further punished. And in addition to which, again, our fallback argument, the fact that he transfers it to Tony, it does add the pool. It adds another person who has their hands on these identifications and on these false documents. And obviously here Tony did go ahead and transfer it on to Payne. But
do we know that Tony did it knowingly?
I mean,
courier,
I'm sorry.
We have no idea. He could have gotten an envelope. I'm not sure that.
He was present at the beginning of the transaction as well, so I think he did know what to do. But I don't know. He was never identified and charged, so that would have been for his jury trial and a fact question for his jury.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Catamanchi, anything further?
I have no rebuttal.
Are there any more questions from the bench? Well, thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.